Voices for the Networked Society, the podcast of the Weizenbaum Institute.
Welcome to the podcast of the Research Group 12, Democracy and Digitalization. My name is Weser Klute-Simon, and this episode contains a talk given by Nicolas Suzor about the need for a new social contract in the digital age and the responsibilities of platforms. Nicolas Suzor is professor at the Law School and chief investigator of the Digital Media Research Center at Queensland University of Technology. His research focuses on the regulation of networked society. In October 2019, his book Lawless, The Secret Rules That Govern Our Digital Lives was published at Cambridge University Press. In the talk that Nicolas Suzor gave on the 26th of November at the Weizenbaum Institute, he takes up this state of lawlessness and addresses issues of accountability and power in the internet and social media. Suzor argues that if we want to confront contemporary problems like hate speech, disinformation, censorship, and so on, we need to design a positive vision of the net in which human rights are strengthened. If we care about the future of our shared social spaces, the lawless rule of tech must be stopped. Instead, Suzor argues we need a new constitutionalism and real limits on how power is exercised online. But now, enjoy listening and hear for yourself what the new social contract in the digital age is all about.
Well, thank you very much, Rob, and thanks, Austin, for organizing. Thank you all for giving me the opportunity here to talk. It was organized very late, so I'm very grateful that that we could fit this in. So, as Rob said, generous introduction. My name's Nick, and today I really want to give you... I want to give you a little bit of an overview of the work we're doing and really start to think about where we go next in terms of embedding human rights values in the governance of technology. Now, I know for a lot of you seem to be working quite heavily in this area, so I'm really keen also to hear about in the discussion what everyone's working on and where there might be some interesting intersections. So mainly four things today. The first, the quite descriptive point that I think does not need a lot of elaboration anymore, is that intermediaries play an important role in governing our online environments, governing the internet. I understand governance here to mean the influence over the course of events in a social system, and looking particularly at the role that intermediaries play, whether they're telecommunications providers, content hosts, platforms, play in regulating and constraining the behavior of individual users and the way that they in turn are acted upon by other actors, both state and non-state actors, who seek to govern what users do and see and say online. Very quickly, the point that there's a lot of movement, both in terms of hard law and self-regulatory initiatives. And moving into the main argument of my paper today is I think that ultimately we need what I call a new constitutionalism, a new way of thinking about how you do due process and accountability when it's done by private telecommunications actors. And I'll talk a little bit about what I think might be some of the opportunities and challenges of doing research and working with civil society and regulators in order to bring that to bear. So let me start with an anecdote, a turning point, I think, not in internet governance, but a turning point in the way that particularly US telecommunications providers talk about their role in governing networks. This is the tragic story of Heather Heyer, who was murdered at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. The Unite the Right rally was a far-right neo-Nazi rally that was that turned violent against a group of counter-protesters when one of the far-right figures ran his car into a group, including Heather Heyer, and tragically killed her on that day. The reason I'm starting with this is because of the particular reaction of Cloudflare and the other telecommunications providers in the aftermath of the Unite the Right rally. One of the main actors in organizing the rally was the Daily Stormer website, a website that the Southern Poverty Law Center called the most popular English language radical right website in the world. And on this website, it was being used to coordinate and to spread news and disinformation about the rally and in the aftermath of the rally. After the rally, the site's editor continued to work to spread misinformation about Hayer and her death. And this was widely condemned globally, that it was a point where it seemed like that this was something on the internet that had gone too far, right? So what's really interesting here is that the Daily Stormer was hosted on its own website. It rented its own VPS. It had control of its own domain, and it used Cloudflare's systems to provide distributed denial of service protection and content distribution. So what happened is that in the aftermath of the tragic events, many of the major infrastructure providers started dropping support for the Daily Stormer website. The domain name was cancelled in turn by GoDaddy, re-registered with Google, cancelled again by Google, who put an administrative hold on it. DigitalOcean dropped the hosting of the virtual private server. During this time, over this week, the Stormer kept on moving to new networks in order to continue hosting. Eventually, Cloudflare made a decision to stop hosting. And the reason I want to focus on Cloudflare is because I think there's an interesting moment here where you see an acknowledgement of the role that telecommunications companies play in choosing what gets to stay and what gets taken down online. This is really interesting from Cloudflare in particular, because for a long time, Cloudflare have said that they stand for free speech and they stand for unpopular speech, and that they won't be bullied into dropping protection or hosting for other sites. So in the midst of this, you've got some people saying, please, Cloudflare, get out of the way so that we can DDoS this site, so we can get it off the internet. And Prince here, the CEO of Cloudflare, has to make a decision about whether or not he's going to drop hosting for the Stormer. What's interesting is the way that he talks about this. He says, in an email to employees, this was my decision. We have power under terms of service to do what we want, but ultimately, my rationale for this was simple. The Daily Stormer are assholes, and I've had enough. He goes on to elaborate. Let me be clear, this is an arbitrary decision, not made according to a set of rules or principles. Literally, he woke up in a bad mood and kicked someone off the internet. And he ends with this provocation that says, I don't think anyone should have this power. And I think this has been a turning point where Prince and others have started to try to work out how they grapple with the power that they wield over who gets hosting online. In the years that have passed, not much has changed, right? And this conversation has opened up, but we haven't seen any real resolution, something I'll get back to later. But at least what I think is interesting is that what might be obvious to all of us, but is certainly not obvious to the US telecommunications companies, is that they play a fundamental political role in providing services to content hosts. So the introduction is, these are, in my view, problems fundamentally of accountability and due process, and they're not going away. From misinformation to hate speech, defamation, copyright infringement, you name it, there's increasing pressure on intermediaries to do more to police the internet. So the first descriptive point is that intermediaries are always at the center of a lot of these debates. That states have long regulated digital media and telecommunications through physical network infrastructure. More recently, states have become better at this, more sophisticated at how they intervene and influence telcos and platforms to either surveil or control what their users are doing. The Snowden revelations, I think, were really important for showing exactly how deep this level of control goes in terms of cooperative agreements with major telecommunications providers and covert surveillance of major backbone networks. On the content level, governments are also starting to figure out how they do content regulation. It wasn't so long ago that the only real power that governments could exercise at a content level was to either block an entire domain or not. And that still happens. We're still getting internet shutdowns just this week. But some governments have worked out where the pressure points are to get major platforms to police content on their behalf. Sometimes this works well. Sometimes it's overseen by a strong foundation in democracy and civil rights, as we see in the German example, for example. Sometimes it's done not so well, where we see Turkey as one of the leaders in censoring platforms like Twitter. When on all measures, Turkey's press freedom is extremely low. We did some quick analysis here of what exactly was being removed in Turkey, and maybe to no one's surprise, but what we found is that there's a lot of legitimate news and political expression that is being censored at the behest of the Turkish government. We found a lot of legitimate and mainstream news outlets that were reporting on the Kurdish crisis who were censored at the request of the Turkish government. And then a spectrum of Kurdish, pro-Kurdish groups towards, at the other end of that spectrum, groups that have been designated as terrorist or extremist organizations under some categorizations, but not all global categorizations. Meanwhile, other private actors are also getting much better at influencing what intermediaries do. Copyright is probably the most developed example where there's a lot of money at stake. And the copyright lobby has been successful at baking protection for its rights directly into the architecture of modern telecommunications platforms and intermediaries. So you see, you know, some of the most common examples are YouTube's Content ID that automatically scans for copyright infringement. That sort of technology has been picked up and is now being expanded to require these types of upload filters or automatic detection of copyright infringement all over Europe and all over the world. We see the copyright agencies getting better at requesting courts for takedown orders that will block entire domains, really trying to combat piracy, but the way that they've done it has become more sophisticated over the last 20 years as they've run out of the major bad actors to sue. 20 years ago, you had actors like Napster, and you can find someone and you can bring a suit against that person and you can shut a network down, or a group of people, and shut a network down. Now it's much more difficult. The only real focal points of action are the telecommunications providers, and that's why we're seeing a lot more action in website blocking around the world. And then all of these controversies spill over into ordinary moments of concern and controversy for the general public. Not a week goes by where there's not a story in major press about how Facebook or Twitter or Google or someone else is unfairly censoring or failing to censor content that people disagree with or want removed. Okay, so all of that is built to a point where now it's clear that regulation is coming. I'm really keen to hear what happens at the IGF this afternoon. What happened last year's IGF at the opening ceremony is that Macron made the point that they weren't going to put up with the US-dominated commercial internet any longer, that they were going, that the French government, in coalition with other governments, was going to try to find a way to intervene to impose content standards on major platforms. In the US, we're seeing this debate play out alternatively in discussions about breaking up some of the major platforms, and otherwise in the president's ongoing complaints that the platforms unfairly discriminate against Republican or conservative viewpoints, a complaint that I think is completely unfounded, but nevertheless is politically significant. One of the things that's really interesting over the last year has been that while there is clear demand to do more in terms of regulating commercial service providers, governments are still struggling to work out exactly how they can do this. What policy levers that governments have that can influence platforms to undertake regulatory projects on the state's behalf? In the aftermath of the Christchurch massacre in New Zealand, terrible shootings at a mosque, this again boiled over into at least two separate streams of state action. The first was the Christchurch call, led by Jacinda Ardern in consultation with the French government, to try to come up with a soft law approach, a set of guidelines that were not really binding, that digital social media platforms and other intermediaries agreed to do better to tackle extremist content. That's a process that is still ongoing. It's been developed in consultation between the government and the private actors. Civil society has been at the periphery of some of these discussions, but not centrally involved. Meanwhile, in Australia, we took a different approach. The Prime Minister of the day, Scott Morrison, decided that the problem lay at the platform level, and all that the Australian government had to do was give platforms a sufficient incentive to get them to remove content. So this all came out in the aftermath that it took, I think, 67 minutes for Facebook to remove the live streaming of the Christchurch massacre. From Facebook's point of view, that is incredibly fast. From the point of view of the Australian government, it's unacceptably slow. Facebook comes out with technical arguments and based on their architecture, that while the live streaming video was live, no one actually reported it. So they didn't get a flag from users until about minute 35. And so they didn't know that there was this content on their platform until about half an hour, and then it took them another half an hour to remove it. And then they talk about how they introduce hash matching and other a little bit more sophisticated systems in order to prevent a lot of direct copies and manipulated copies from continuously being re-uploaded over the next week or two. The Australian government said, ultimately, this sounds like a Facebook problem, and that all they needed to do was create enough of an incentive. And so the incentive came out, the Borrowed Vinyl Material Act, drafted in 48 hours with zero negotiation, either with tech companies or with civil societies, that imposes quite heavy penalties on digital media operators. 3 years imprisonment for executives, 10% of global revenue for failing to remove what they define as abhorrent violent material. Now, those of us who study intermediary liability have complained for a long time about unbalanced incentives, that this creates a very strong incentive for platforms to remove content, but no real incentive to be careful for rights of freedom of expression or due process. That, I think, is a major problem. Content warning here, I'm going to show an image of something that is, under this definition, abhorrent violent material, but is what we would consider to be really important, legitimate political expression. So look away for the next 60 to 90 seconds if you don't want to see this. It is a picture of the Abu Ghraib massacres perpetuated by US troops. Sorry, the Abu Ghraib torture perpetuated by US troops in the Middle East. This is an image that was taken by a perpetrator. It depicts torture. It clearly falls within our definition in Australia of abhorrent violent material. There are no safeguards in the Australian Act to for either a platform or a user concerned to contest a decision either by a platform or by the regulator to order this material to be removed under stiff penalty. The photo's up on Wikipedia, right? If the, technically under current law, the people in power at, or some of the people in power at the Wikimedia Foundation, or maybe some of the volunteer editors at Wikipedia, could be criminally liable for documenting abuse and torture. Okay, so all of this to say is that regulation is definitely coming, but regulation is really tough to get right. Getting the incentives right in a way that gets platforms and telcos to do what you want while protecting fundamental rights and due process is a really tough thing to do. In Australia, unfortunately, we don't have a constitutional bill of rights, and we don't have any ability for a court to go through and to narrow down the scope of these types of obligations. Meanwhile, here in Europe, there's an ongoing conversation about what exactly providers and might do and how you might use and adopt some of the mechanisms for regulating broadcast media and classifying content that is put out on broadcast media to a digital platform environment. That's tough. Okay, but the point of all of this is that while there's a lot of pressure, there's always going to be a large level of discretion that private companies exercise. There's, in my, in this very rough drawing, you know, a subset of category that we can say is clearly unlawful in a particular jurisdiction. And that's more or less well-defined, depending on the particular issue. Then there's a broader set of material that is prohibited by the terms of service of platforms, material that is not unlawful for private citizens to see or to share, but that platforms decide does not belong on their particular environment. And then there's this much broader category of things we don't like on the internet, offensive or harmful speech, some forms of misinformation that are not unlawful, and so on. In all but that relatively well-defined box of unlawful content, platforms have to make very clear determinations of whether they think material should be allowed to stay up or not. In all of the controversies I showed at the start, this zone of influence is going to become incredibly important. A lot of people want the major social platforms to do more to combat hate speech, disinformation, and election interference, and so on. Some of that can be regulated, but the scale we're talking about and the types of the decisions we're talking about, where not all of the content is unlawful, means that there's a lot of room for discretion on the platforms. When you look at the scale, this becomes pretty clear. Google, for example, processes 75, 80 million copyright takedowns every month. Most of those sent by major copyright organizations, a small portion sent by everyone else. They've been improving this. They've been working to improve their consistency and accuracy against their own measures, but it's really hard to, one, work out from an external point of view, how well this system is working. And even from an internal perspective, even with target accuracy rates of above 98%, we're still dealing with hundreds of thousands of mistakes every single week. Not something that can be easily solved by the institutions that we have that are used to dealing with these sorts of problems. The courts and regulators can't deal with this sort of volume in the current way that they're set up and constituted. There's also, I think, a fundamental problem in the way that platforms think about and action these operationalize, if you want to use their terms, their policies. They're at this sort of scale, when they're focused on dealing with the scale that the major platforms have to deal with, there's a fundamental trade-off between accuracy on the one hand, which is the importance of creating clear, bright line rules that can that are easy to implement, and sensitivity to context on the other hand, where you need more information or you need to understand the underlying power relations in order to understand whether something is actually harmful and avoid removing important counter speech. Classic examples include the long-running controversies over breastfeeding and female nudity on Facebook and other major US platforms, where we see clearly that Western ideals of a particular feminine ideal and that can be commercialized tend to be protected, and we see ongoing complaints from, in this case, indigenous activists that their culture is being unfairly censored by the application of these content standards. This is a problem with hate speech, with everything else that platforms have to deal with, that the particular meaning of a piece of content depends upon its context. And the current systems of content moderation that major social media platforms deploy are not particularly sensitive to context. These are decisions that have to be made quickly. They are decisions that are generally made individually on the piece of content, not always with all of the extra context about who's posting it, to whom, who reported it, what might be going on, and certainly not with all of the extra social and cultural knowledge that would be required to understand whether something is actually hate speech, whether it's legitimate counter speech or legitimate political expression. So the point of the book is the argument that we need a new constitutionalism, and that maybe overstates it a little bit, because I think what we really need is to figure out how we apply the historical and existing constitutional principles that operate to protect people from the abuse of, or the arbitrary abuse of power, to these different systems, to content moderation systems in particular in this talk, but we can extend that out to otherwise think about how tech companies make decisions and embed values in their products and in their services, and think about how do we go about protecting fundamental rights and procedural rights in that context. So the current way that this is done, very badly. This is one of my favorite quotes from 2009, where Zuckerberg, in the wake of another privacy scandal, 10 years ago now, said, "We're going to fix the terms of service. These are the governing documents that we are all going to live by, and therefore you all need to have a say in how our rules are made and enforced." That promise was remarkably short-lived. Maybe it was before its time. If we give Zuckerberg the benefit of the doubt, maybe the world wasn't ready for a truly participatory rulemaking on Facebook, but either way, their limited experiment with direct democracy crashed and burned in a fairly spectacular fashion. What's interesting, I think, is that these comments have now been disavowed. If you go back on the Wayback Machine, you'll find that they are no longer attributed to Zuckerberg, and instead to a PR person who has now left the company. The point is that terms of service documents are bad constitutional documents. They are drafted by lawyers in a way that is designed to protect the rights of the platform. So they allocate almost all the power that they can, to the greatest extent possible on the law of the various jurisdictions in which they operate, to the platform. You get terms like, "We reserve the right in our ultimate discretion to terminate user accounts at any time for any reason or indeed for no reason." Those form the backbone of the claim to legitimacy that platforms make about how they govern their networks. You people are participants in these social media spaces with the sole permission of the platform provider. And that permission can be revoked at any time with the practical effect that people have very little power to contest these decisions. Now, I say this with some limitations. Obviously, in Germany, there have been a few decisions over the last few years, and I'm sure some of you in this room will know more about them than I do, where courts have started to apply fundamental principles to the terms of service and require platforms to reinstate certain bits of content. But that's certainly the exception. That doesn't happen almost anywhere else in the world. With the upshot being that there are currently no real and effective mechanisms to promote accountability in due process. Everything we know about how decisions are made in private platforms comes out of leaked documents, lobbying information, small bits of reporting from dedicated investigative reporters, and whatever we can reverse engineer from outside as academics. There is very little visibility into how platforms make or enforce their rules. Worse, this is a problem that is accelerating. We still don't have good information about all of the other associated decisions. So far, I've only been talking about decisions to remove or leave up. Then we've got the operation of recommendation systems and search engines that shape how we experience the world. The current concerns about misinformation are often criticized the way that platforms amplify misinformation or harmful speech in a way that maximizes either their commercial interests or responds to the commercial interests of their users, people who have learned how to monetize misinformation and manipulate the recommendation systems of the major platforms, and have built symbiotic relationships with more mainstream media providers. And they are currently gaming the media ecosystem to spread disinformation and harmful content. Okay, so this brings us to another Cloudflare story. More recent this time, but nothing's changed. Cloudflare decided to drop 8chan a few months ago. And again, Prince, the CEO of Cloudflare, comes out and says, enough is enough, I've made this decision, but it was really hard. 2 years have passed, but apparently we haven't really got to the point. Certainly Cloudflare has not got to the point where they have an answer to how to think through these problems yet. He does have a vocabulary, which is interesting, that Prince, a US-trained lawyer, falls back to the idea of the rule of law as a touchstone of legitimacy, borrowing these constitutional principles of the rule of law to think about how Cloudflare should ideally make decisions about who gets to speak on its networks. This, I think, is really interesting. Interesting because I think he's correct in that these are the principles that we use to evaluate the legitimacy of governance, the way that power is exercised over other people in a coordinated way. When I talk about rule of law, I really think about five basic principles: that there is meaningful consent of some kind, that there is transparency in terms of what the rules are, and particularly in the reasons that are given for when a rule is enforced, that the rules are enforced in a procedurally sound way, fairly equally and fairly predictably, that there are mechanisms for due process to remedy the inevitable mistakes, and the substantive one that, depending on the sort of system that you're studying, that the rules are designed to promote some justifiable vision of the common good. When we measure terms of service against these principles, predictably, they do very badly. But I do think that these are the right principles to use at the moment, with one caveat that it's missing the substance. It's hidden in this last one, a justifiable vision of the human good. I think the substantive vision is human rights, as I'll get to later. But this is how we regulate and how we guard against the arbitrary exercise of power. Now, this doesn't mean that the rule of law looks the same in all contexts. It doesn't mean that Facebook needs to implement the same judicial institutions and other social institutions that exist to safeguard the rule of law in a democracy. But it does mean that the values of the rule of law can be used for us to have a conversation about what we might expect. I think that's an important point that I'll come back to. So where are we now? What we're seeing is as regulatory pressure increases and as public pressure increases, the telcos are reacting. I think there's a wide understanding that there is a crisis of trust amongst the major US social media networks in particular. That is a fundamental threat to them. You see Zuckerberg responding to Elizabeth Warren's campaign that said that one plank of which centers on breaking up Facebook and some of the other major telcos. When they talk about that, they see that as an existential threat. So what that means is that over the last 5 years, the major platforms have invested quite heavily in trying to, one, lobby through traditional political channels, but two, also demonstrate and try to regain some of their legitimacy in the way they govern their networks. So transparency is improving. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, it was really hard to get figures about how platforms moderate the speech of their users. Those reports now come out every 6 months and they're getting more detailed every time. Platforms are starting to realize that users have been essentially making up their own folk theories when they have material that is removed because of the lack of information that is available. And in response, you can see that platforms are working a little bit to provide more information about what exactly their terms do and do not prohibit, how they're operationalized, more information directly to users when their content gets reported or detected by an automated system, to try to help people understand what's going on. But still, you know, this is pretty limited. The information we're getting is still very high level. It's hard to use this in a meaningful way that can actually be used to hold platforms to account. Then we see self-regulatory institutional developments. Facebook's Supreme Court, as Zuckerberg calls it, or the Oversight Board, as Facebook now calls it, to give Facebook credit, they have worked hard to develop an independent organization that will have direct influence over decisions made by Facebook. This is run by an independent trust. The trustees are appointed by Facebook, funded by Facebook, but then Facebook has very little ongoing control over the trust. It's been developed in a way that is designed on the one hand, minimize influence by Facebook, and on the other hand, maximize the legitimacy of having an independent oversight body grants to Facebook. So this is clearly a response when Zuckerberg and some of the other tech CEOs come out and say, we don't want to be responsible for making these decisions. He's trying to avoid having to make hard calls that will invariably upset a lot of people, no matter what he decides. So punting those sorts of questions off to an oversight board makes a lot of sense. It's diffusing some of the calls, or at least aimed at diffusing some of the calls for greater hard regulation by improving their self-regulatory institutions. So we can be quite cynical, but also, it's actually super interesting in the way that this body does actually have the ability to make decisions about particular bits of content. It will, those decisions might be binding on the general form of a particular case. Exactly how that works, I have no idea, but I'm keen to find out. But more importantly, it can offer advisory opinions on policy to Facebook. And those written opinions, Facebook has to respond to. Even if they choose not to implement them, they have to respond. And so you can envisage a scenario where the oversight board starts to get fed up with, I don't know, Facebook's hate speech or advertising policies, and starts to be another point of pressure on Facebook to try to change their policies from within. All right. Is it as good as an external real hard law regulation? No. Obviously, it doesn't have that sort of binding effect. But can it make a difference in terms of improving the substance of Facebook policy and improving the process of enforcing Facebook policy? Yeah, it could be. It's going to be a really interesting time as this thing rolls out over the next year. Interestingly, none of the other platforms have done anything like this. YouTube's had a bad year, but has done almost nothing to respond or improve the way that it makes decisions about hate speech and disinformation on its networks. So you do have to give some credit to Facebook, even if you also recognize that this is motivated out of a desire to avoid further public regulation. What's missing is a real commitment to human rights. So far, what we're talking about is procedural. You look at Facebook's oversight board, what it does is apply the letter of Facebook policy in the context of the spirit of Facebook's values. And its values are a set of values that prioritize what they call voice, speech. Safety, to Facebook's view, is a secondary, subsidiary concern to speech. It's a particularly US perspective, but it structures how they think about all of their content policy. What that means, unfortunately, is that Facebook has not yet learnt, well, the lesson of Yahoo in 2007, when its networks were used by the Chinese government to jail dissidents, or the lesson of Facebook in 2014, when Facebook played a contributing role to the genocide in Myanmar. And it should have known better. It should have been alert to the harms that it could cause when it goes into a country without understanding the local context, without even having people who can understand the language on their moderation and process teams, without even having the ability to use their technical tools to evaluate language, because the Burmese script is not a Unicode font and doesn't work with their machine learning classifiers. They have not learnt this lesson, that the actions they take have real impact on the rights of individuals, and we still haven't seen a real commitment to fundamental, substantive human rights. Okay, so shout out to Rob with his beautiful diagram of the constellation of regulatory initiatives in Europe, and a way of, more importantly, a way of understanding where these different initiatives sit. Between the roles of state, civil society, and corporate actors. I think this is an interesting and important framing for where I think we should go next, which is, we kind of understand how to do, well, we think we understand how to do due process, accountability, human rights protection at the top end of this scale, at the state side. We are learning somewhat how we might do horizontal human rights on the right-hand side of this scale, where states and firms cooperate in a way that courts can exercise some oversight, in a way that government regulators can exercise potentially some oversight. firms are still pushing towards the bottom right side of this pyramid. GIFCT is the counterterrorism hash database. That's the firm's preferred response to extremist content, problems of extremist content, because it's a fully private system. There's no oversight, either by civil society or by the state. But we're seeing different actors, state and civil society, trying to drag these results away from the firm side, or in civil society's case, away from the old compromises between state and private actors that we see over there on the top right-hand side in Area 4. Unfortunately, civil society still has a long way to go here, that we go around and we develop the Santa Clara principles or the Manila principles on intermediary liability, and they don't have a lot of impact. They have some impact when they're useful to firms to lobby against more heavy-handed regulatory instruments. And so we have seen firms adopt the bits of the Santa Clara principles that they feel like adopting as a way of reaching out to civil society and as a way of hedging against more regulation, improving trust in their networks. But I think there's still a long way to go to find how we might actually build accountability systems that work. Fundamentally, constitutionalization, which is what I'm talking about here, the proceduralization, if you will, of private decision-making. If you accept my premise that private platforms are going to have a lot of discretion, and that discretion matters for human rights, then I think the conclusion that I want to advance is that proceduralization matters, that the way that platforms exercise that discretion matters, and that we should be arguing for a more legitimate form of discretion. This is not necessarily to crowd out state regulation, which I think is important, but to say that in that zone of self-regulation, we should be expecting more. We're seeing civil society make really big inroads in how they do this. I think what is most exciting to me at the moment is that I do think we are at a moment of potential change. We're at a moment where the platforms do feel themselves to be under an existential threat. And I think, I'm not very optimistic, but I'm a tiny bit optimistic that we might be able, as combined academics, civil society, regulators, to exert pressure in a way that improves governance on a day-to-day basis. The Ranking Digital Rights Corporate Accountability Index provides one way to bring that pressure to bear, provides an annual index of how well companies are doing on privacy and freedom of expression measures. I think this is a really interesting research and civil society collaboration that tries to bring that pressure to bear to bring home more accountability. Ultimately, accountability has to be more than transparency. Transparency by itself is empty. It's worse than empty. It's a lobbying technique that platforms deploy in order to ward off criticism. Real accountability requires us, those of us who study platforms, those of us who advocate for change, to have a way to actually hold the platforms to account on a substantive level. We wrote the Santa Clara principles in order, as a first step to improving the very low baseline of transparency. And now we have some figures. The challenge for the next iteration of the Santa Clara principles and for people who care about transparency is to figure out how we get our hands on the data that would actually allow us to evaluate how well platforms are going. Now, this is in the context where many of the major platforms are clamping down on researcher access to data, particularly after the Cambridge Analytica scandal. APIs are closing down, as I'm sure many of you here know. It's getting harder and harder for us to do the types of research that is required to hold platforms to account. We're launching a discussion, a process over the next year to create a revised and completely new set of principles on accountability, transparency, and content moderation. I invite all of you who are interested to connect with me after this. as we talk about a schedule of work over the next year, where we're going to try to open up a much larger discussion with civil society and with academics to figure out exactly what we should be demanding, and then put some energy and focused lobbying behind that to try to improve mechanisms of accountability. That'll proceed over the next year for launch in February 2021. And I want to end just on some personal, research projects that I'm currently pursuing and that I think could help to provide some of this transparency. In terms of, I think one of the key problems is we need methodological innovation. A lot of the work on content moderation, because of the secrecy, means that it's done on isolated incidents. And it's really hard to measure how well platforms are doing across our public constitutional values over time and to compare across platforms. I think there's an opportunity here for a lot more collaboration within academia, between people to bring new methods and new data to bear to try to hold platforms to account. We're building observatories at the moment that try to provide a sample of content that's removed in particular countries, and we can tell over a number of different platforms exactly who's requesting the removal of what types of content on what basis. And hopefully we'll be able to see that over time, and we can, with that sort of infrastructure, enable much more in-depth qualitative work that tries to figure out what exactly is going on in a way that's more generalizable. A quick shout out to some of my PhD students here. Alice, for example, who used this infrastructure to code for bias against women on Instagram, looking at the set of images that were removed on the Instagram platform and coding them for nudity, for gender, and for, in this case, body shape. And using that to really show at a particular point in time exactly how Instagram systems were operating. Maybe surprising no one, it turns out that images of women's bodies are removed at 15 times the rate of images of men's bodies when you control for the same general level of nudity. Super interesting stuff that you can start to do with these sorts of methods. One of my postdocs, Joe Gray, is looking at content moderation on YouTube, using machine learning classification to try to break down, starting from a set of key controversies, using classifiers to find a set of content to analyze. Remember at the first slide, one of the first slides I showed was just the sheer volume of content we're looking at. The proportion of content that's removed for copyright violation might only be 0.5%, right, across the board. Or it turns out to be under 7%, under 5% across the board on YouTube. Now, within that, most of that is unobjectionable. So if you want to start finding, it's the needle in the haystack problem, if you want to start finding particular patterns of moderation amongst particular subsets of content, you need different approaches to be able to sample effectively. A random sample wouldn't turn up enough to be able to look at, so we developed a classifier that enabled us to set out 5 key buckets of things we were interested in and zoom in, build samples of YouTube takedowns that fall within those buckets, and then we can see who exactly is requesting what to be removed on YouTube. So that's kind of cool, and I'm excited about those sorts of methodological advances. Another one of my postdocs, Rosalie Gillett, is again using classification techniques, text classification, to try to look for misogynistic harassment and prohibited abuse on Twitter, and we can measure. We can measure Twitter's success in or otherwise of its commitment to do something about abuse. For years and years now, Twitter has admitted that it's got an abuse problem, and it's made some architectural changes, but it's still struggling to figure out how to deal with harmful content on its platform. And so we should be able to measure with any given regulatory intervention, whether it's something like NetzDG in Germany, or whether it's something like a simple rule change on behalf of the platforms, we should be able to see rates of removal and levels of harmful content if we can catch it accurately enough, which is always a challenge, but we should then be able to measure what sort of interventions work. And we should be able to correlate to external events. When does hate speech increase around elections? What strategy works to limit the distribution of hate speech? That's kind of cool stuff. I'm really excited about that work. And so that's it. I think not many answers here. A lot of descriptive work and laying out of the problem. But I do think the takeaway is that we need, as academics and civil society, in our part to build better partnerships with civil society and with regulators to study how platforms are regulating, but also what works, what are the effects, what are the unintended consequences of different modes of intervention in platform governance? What are the new institutions that we could create in order to do due process at scale in a way that might improve the way the platforms make decisions? Greater participation at CIGF, I have to say, multi-stakeholderism is an idea. It's been an idea for a while with fairly limited take-up, but we should still be working to improve the way that we work together across different sectors. And then I think the real work of accountability. It's not new to the tech field. We need to figure out and learn from other areas how you hold corporate interests accountable. So far, I think, as I said earlier, we've been doing this a little bit in isolation as internet exceptionalism, to think of these digital actors as completely novel. But these are the politics of working to constrain corporate interests. And they're long established and they're difficult and they need a lot of collaboration and a lot of creativity. So that's where I'm going to leave it. Thank you so much for your time.